We'll call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. All five members are present. It's approximately 1:35 p.m. Thursday, March 19th, 2009. Present to my left, Senator Bundy and Senator Davis. To my right, Senator Meyer and Senator Thomas, and myself, Senator Pascvan. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up the following legislation. We will begin with Senate Bill 138 by Senator Meyer relating to the tax credit for state tourism programs, and Senate Bill 97 relating to the crane operators licensing, and Senate Bill 149 relating to mortgage lending. Thank everyone in the audience for joining us today. It is my intent to hear from the bill sponsors and the administration and public testimony on each of these bills, and there's been a considerable amount of information that's been received and shared with this committee members by the sponsors and their advocates, and I hope that we are well informed and about each of these bills, and I look forward to our discussion here today. It is my intent to move the first two bills, Senate Bill 138 and Senate Bill 97, from committee, and we will hear and then hold the mortgage lending bill. We want to hear a little bit more about that, but first we will hear about Senate Bill 138. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The floor is yours or your committee member, which or your staff member, whichever is your preference.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'd like to move the CS for Senate Bill number 138, / P.
Any objection? That committee substitute is now before this committee.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn over the overview of the bill itself to my trustee staff.
Please identify yourself and your affiliation, and please provide your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Christine R. Marisigan, and I'm a staffer to Senator Kevin Meyer, the sponsor of Senate Bill 138. I'm going to give a little bit of background about Senate Bill 138 and then kind of go through a little bit about the bill and what it does. And I'm sure the senator's free to jump in at any time to correct, rebuke, or participate. Each year, the Alaska Travel Industry Association, which is the nonprofit, member-based visitor industry trade association that conducts marketing on behalf of the state of Alaska, makes a request for funds to promote an Alaska tourism marketing program. So last year, the legislature applied a three-year sunset clause to the match requirement, which currently has a 70-30 split with the state of Alaska and private industry. And currently, statewide car rental tax, which is about $9 million, combines with private industry match, $2.7 million, make up the total tourism marketing budget. In FY09, this was a total of $11.7 million. Now, last year, the legislature requested that the travel industry come back to the table with a long-term tourism marketing funding growth plan. And so this is just a little bit of background to kind of get you up to speed as to what's been happening in the budgetary process for ATIA. Well, this, what you're looking at in front of you, CSSB 138, is part of that plan. Basically, this would establish a tourism marketing tax credit towards the recently approved Water's Edge corporate cruise income tax. This corporate cruise income tax is one portion of the state's estimated tourism revenues, and if you have the pie chart that's in your committee packet, you'll see that it's got it broken down and set out there. And if you go through the bill and CSSB 138, this would not allow any other contributions to be used as a tax credit. Specifically on page 2, line 2, it makes sure that any other sort of contributions, like a payment into the visitor planning guide, any kind of pay-to-play type contributions, could not be included in this tax credit. This also does not allow the tax credits to carry over from year to year. So basically, you've got to use it within that year. This is a very specific tax credit, which would then be reinvested to promote the state of Alaska as a tourism destination. We do have some folks here in the room that are ready and able to answer questions that you might have. We also have Mr. Dan Stickle, I believe, online, who's from the Department of Revenue to answer any questions you might have about corporate tax revenue. Mr. Brett Carlson, who's chair of the ATIA board, is here today, and as is, Ron Peck. who's president of ATIA, can answer questions regarding this bill in regards to tourism marketing. Thank you for your time. I ask for your support of this bill.
Senator Bundy, question for Christine?
Or perhaps for the our tax person. We have a fiscal note to the original bill. Does this also apply substantially similar to the CS?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, as I understand as the bill is currently written, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so the maximum potential liability were people to take advantage of it to the fullest extent would be something under $16 million.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, from what I understand in terms of what we've been provided from the Department of Revenue, that would also be correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have a sign-in sheet here. I believe the first person is Brett, or any other. Before we do that, excuse me, sorry, Senator Meyer.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, and in fact, Christine did an excellent job. In my previous life as co-chair of finance, I was working with ATA a lot, and we were searching for ways to find a long-term solution to funding tourism marketing in this state, and we all know how important tourism is to us. And then they approached me with this idea, and I thought this was an excellent idea because obviously the cruise ships are part of the tourism industry, and so I thought it was a good match. I think Senator Bundy brings up a good point. You know, the dollar amount may go up as more cruise ships come to Alaska. Hopefully there'll be more coming and not leaving. That dollar amount could fluctuate both higher and lower. And so I would suggest that, you know, this bill next goes to the Finance Committee, and at that point in time, they may want to look at, you know, putting a cap on it in case it gets higher than the dollar amount the state's comfortable with.
Okay. Does that prompt any additional questions? Thank you to the Christine. Brett Carlson. Please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and provide the testimony.
Brett Carlson, Northern Alaska Tour Company. I'm just the volunteer chair with the Alaska Travel Industry Association. And Christine did an excellent job, so we'll try to explaining what the bill is and just share a few words as to why we think it's tourism marketing tax credit is a great thing for Alaskans. First of all, as all of you know, a strong and growing economy plays a very important role in helping Alaska families balance their budget.
Sorry about that. Usually they're moving them closer.
And one nice thing about the travel industry, it really represents proven economic development, not a pie in the sky theory. 2 million annual visitors each year don't arrive with empty pockets. They bring $1.8 billion new dollars to Alaska, create 40,000 plus jobs. And very important for each of you is the pie chart you already looked at shows now bring $122 million that they leave in this building, I guess upstairs with the Finance Committee to help the state balance the budget. The very important thing I think that ATIA believes, an exciting thing about the travel industry, is it really provides amazing opportunities for small businesses to participate at the ownership level. And if you look around the world at economic development tools, that one economic development tool in the travel industry that allows the travel industry not just to grow, but to grow in a way that keeps ensures it's balanced and diversified and leaves a space at the economic table, a prominent space for small Alaskan businesses, it's a tourism marketing program. You know, it works in Alaska, it works around the world. And you absolutely shouldn't take my word for it. We're proud to say that Alaska's tourism marketing program that you came up with is private industry-led, market-driven, and research-based. And the research shows, you know, just like if you enact an oil tax credit to drill more wells, if you drill more wells, you'll get more oil. Same thing with marketing. If you buy more advertising or do other sorts of marketing, get people to raise their hands and say, hey, state of Alaska, I'm coming to Alaska. We actually go back in 2005, for example, 500,000 people that we contacted raised their hand and said, I want more information, I'm interested in coming. So we do research the next 4 years to see how many of those persons actually came to Alaska. And we know, based on research in 2005, over the next 4 years, in 05, 06, 07, and 08, 45% of those people that raised their hand came to Alaska. So it's economic development that truly works. So why are we here? We have tourism marketing. It works. Why on earth would we need to be talking today? And the chart that really explains why we're here is this chart, which I think is not numbered, but number 12. And it essentially shows that in inflation-adjusted dollars in 1990, the state's contribution to the tourism marketing program was, in inflation-adjusted dollars, was just over $24 million. Over time, it went into decline. And this, there's other examples around the country to see what happens when tourism marketing declines, and it hurts small businesses the most in Alaska, and it certainly has had that effect in Alaska. So we were concerned as we hit the low point of this graph here, you know, engaged with the legislature on ways we could come up with a long-term tourism marketing funding model. Legislature was unequivocally clear, saying if you're going to come up with a model, those dollars need to come from travel industry generated revenues. Came to the table the last couple years and came up with the first step in a long-term solution, which you can see here in 2009 had results, and that was the reinvestment of the vehicle rental tax. And that essentially is the flow of revenue coming into the state from independent travel. As Christine said, and Senator Meyer said, the legislature told us last year, come back with the second part of the solution that also comes from travel industry generated taxes. It seemed logical that with independent travel having a funding source into our goal of a $20 million program, get back to where we were 20 years ago, it made sense for cruise travel to come in. We wanted to limit the target of those taxes just to those new taxes that were paid after the initiative. So it was a real finite amount. And so from a big picture perspective, the reason we think, we hope it resonates with you and with other Alaskans, is that each year, you know, the state of Alaska, when we go to the Finance Committee, will come with a bag currently of $122 million, reinvest a reasonable percentage of that. We'll grow the industry. Not only will it have benefits for the private sector, but the next year we'll come back with a little larger bag of money. And I think no more important point than this is a plan that will not hurt, it will actually help the state's ability to balance the budget. And it's a policy decision that we really think makes sense to grow the economy. The final point I'll make, and nobody needs to know this, but there is an economic crisis in the world. It is certainly affecting the travel industry. And we do travel intention studies to try to guess who's no longer going to come to Alaska. Those are showing a drop of up to 30%. Anecdotally, when you actually talk to businesses, anywhere from 30 to 60% is the decline in bookings for Alaskan businesses. As you get further away from the water to the rail belt and up, those numbers are the most scary. I mean, at best, the coming visitor season is going to be grim. At worst, it's going to be shocking. You know, our case, and we're kind of proud of this fact, that we're not coming in the era of the bailout. We're not coming to the legislature looking for a bailout. We're saying, hey, thanks, you gave us a key tool last year. We're looking for one more tool, which is this tax credit, to help us help ourselves. And certainly not all businesses will survive the coming year, but those that do survive, if this tax credit's in place, we pass it this year, we'll be able to move forward. So thanks for considering.
Thank you, Brett. Senator Bundy.
On your point of reduced, or the economic impact on tourism, you know, as I said, the maximum at this point projected, if all the taxes were claimed as credit, would be $15 million. You know, I've heard anecdotally that cruises are seriously discounted now, and they're really scratching to fill boats. Have you got any idea of what projection, how low could this go? Would there be, would it be 10 million? Would it be 5?
It could certainly, I mean, impossible to project, but certainly year to year, the tax credit can go up and down, and certainly it may be next year. Next year we may be able to determine what the floor on this tax credit is going to be, so it may be instructive. One good thing about it is that that tax credit is not going to grow unless tourism marketing works. So it does create a feedback.
I know that there's a witness that appears.
I just wanted to make one more. Let's go ahead with the testimony. That's fine. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy.
Before we do.
Yeah, you do.
for the record. Identify who you are and your affiliation. And
my name is Ron Peck. I'm president of the Alaska Travel Industry Association, and happy to be in Senator Bundy's district. Through the chair to Senator Bundy, the most current information we have about the cruise season this year, Senator, is the following. Bookings are starting to increase, but you're absolutely correct, where they're starting to fill their ships. But the most current survey I recently read in a travel press was that the yields are down about, on average for Alaska, about 20 to 30% in terms of that average price.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the committee of either Mr. Peck or Mr. Carlson? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only concern I've had voiced to me so far about this was the same thing that came up last year. That's the concept that when the cruise ship head tax was put in place, that was charged back to the customer of the cruise ship. You know, that was just on their ticket actually was a charge for $50 for that trip to Alaska. And I don't know if that's accurate or not, because I haven't taken a cruise to see if that's the case. And prior to that, the cruise ship industry had been contributing a couple million dollars, I guess industry-wise, cruise ship, a couple million dollars on an annual basis to the tourism marketing effort. So the only thing that's been expressed to me was if, in fact, they're charging the customers the $50 for the head tax, and now they're going to get a credit for the money that they had been giving prior to the cruise ship tax being implemented, being angry about it happening, I guess, to begin with, because obviously it put some pressure on cruises, because now there's an extra $50 charge to the customer, which is just a pass through the cruise ship other than some accounting and on to the state of Alaska, that now they are receiving a credit for the same money that they may have contributed on their own prior to that. So that's just only something that I've heard, so I don't know if it'll get legs or if it's going to mean anything when this gets up to finance or not, but that is at least an issue that I have, and I don't know if you care to comment on that or know that that's accurate or not, as far as whether the $50 is just kind of flow through.
Yeah, thanks for passing that along, and clearly, I mean, any economist is going to say, and we should know that anytime we increase taxes on businesses in Alaska, whether it's shown to the customer above the line or below the line, it has to be passed on to them, because there's no other place to get it from. Clearly, that issue last year with the legislation that the legislature passed, you know, overwhelming 20-0 and 35-1, we moved away from that previous model, had a lot of discussion about it, realized it wasn't the model that would work for the future, have moved to a new model, which is based on a reinvestment of a portion of travel industry revenues. And it seems to make sense that with independent travel having a revenue stream, that cruise travel would also have a revenue stream.
May I just?
Yes, certainly. Mr. Peck, please.
Just for the record, if in fact this bill is passed, the amount of revenue that would be generated would be, as we've said, somewhere between $10 and $12 million, we estimate. For the record, the cruise industry still participates in our programs on an annualized basis by buying into our programs in advertising, acquiring lead generation, advertising on the internet, somewhere in the vicinity of $500,000 to $600,000. And prior to, as you said, this new plan, their maximum annual contribution from a donation standpoint was between 1.9 and 2 million. So we would grow that substantially in terms of what their contribution would be.
Thank you.
Thank you. We would now no further questions for Mr. Carlson.
Thanks for all you do.
From the committee, I believe they're Joanna Bales, Department of Revenue. I don't know if that's raised any issues that you would like to comment upon.
Yeah, for the record, this is Joanna Bales. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division. Probably the only, I can just add a little light there to Senator Thomas's question about whether or not that commercial passenger vessel excise tax is charged above the line to passengers. And it's my understanding that it is. I have had contacts with actual passengers who were upset when they saw the the fee charged to them separate on their bill. But what I'd like to point out is that this amount of money, this tax credit that we're talking about, doesn't offset that tax. What it offsets is the corporate income tax that the cruise ships are required to pay. And as the individual, the president of ATIA, suggested, normally those types of taxes do get passed on below the line to passengers, you know, to the customers in any industry. So I don't know if that helps.
Senator Thomas.
It helps at least establish that that was that accurately, that they were charged that. And I realize that this is just a credit for taxation, not necessarily against the cruise ship money. So not a problem. I understand. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Hi, Joanna. Was it your shop a few years ago, out of some kind of frustration with magic numbers, I asked that Department of Revenue give us a report, us the legislature report, of the net return to the state of various industries. Is that your shop that did that?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I know that you asked us for a report of uncollected corporate income tax. Is that what you're referring to?
No. It was a matter of, you know, we spent a lot of money promoting various industries and what was the net return to the general fund. And if it doesn't ring a bell, that wasn't your shop. So, okay.
I don't recall it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanna Bales. No further questions that I see from the committee for you. We will now move to Deborah Day, that the Juneau off-site, I believe. Deborah K., possibly.
Yes, I'm here.
Please identify yourself. State your
yes, actually, my name is Deborah K., and I'm from Senator Meyer's neck of the woods, and first of all, I'd like to thank him for introducing this bill. I've actually been in Alaska since 1986 and have made my living in tourism for the last 20 years. And supporting of this bill will help to continue the growth of our tourism industry because of the marketing dollars that we'll have. And that will allow me to continue to support myself and my family. And I very much encourage everyone on the committee to pass this bill on.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kay. Any questions? For Ms. Kay, seeing none, we will now, Ethan Tyler.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Ethan Tyler. I'm with Siri Alaska Tourism Corporation. I am one of Senator Bundy's supporters and constituents. I'm a Girdwood resident, Girdwood 2020 board member. Most importantly, I'm a proud husband and father. And I support myself also and my family with the tourism industry. And as Mr. Carlson mentioned, with a shrinking worldwide economy, it's more important than ever for us to, as Alaska, to have a strong and competitive presence in the marketplace. And this bill would ensure long-term and sustainable funding for the Alaska Travel Industry Marketing Program that allows us to promote our state and to make sure that we continue to grow this industry and bring visitors here. So I would encourage this committee to pass this bill and pass it on. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tyler. Any questions for Mr. Tyler? Seeing none, we'll move to David Kasser.
Thank you. This is David Kasser for the record. And I reside in Senator Davis's district. I'm a small business owner also in that district, as well as Vice President of Tourism for the Anchorage Convention Visitor Bureau. And I'm calling firstly to thank both Senator Meyer and for Senator Davis to bring this bill forward. What I'm seeing out on the road doing my work promoting Anchorage and South Central Alaska and the state in its entirety is a lot of alarm, a lot of concern in every realm of just about every industry. And this is no news to all of you, but I know that Alaska could work to be more welcoming of this industry. I know that the cruise industry particularly is being wooed globally to bring their business, to bring their ships and the passengers and their incremental spending that goes with that. And I think that any bill that we introduce that helps to make them feel welcome, that we're working in a partnership to sell the overall destination, is one that bodes well for every resident, every person employed by tourism, and the spending that they do in their communities. So I do thank both Senator Meyer and Davis for bringing this bill forward. I implore the rest of the committee to strongly consider it and to move it forward. I think there's never been a better time to show interest in tourism and support of growing the industry than right now. So again, I thank you all for your due diligence in this process, and I'll ring off at that point unless there's any questions.
Any questions for the witness? Seeing none, I believe we now move to Fairbanks, Deb Hickok.
Hello, this is Deb Hickok, and I'm President and CEO of the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau. And I wanted to thank the committee on behalf of the visitor industry in the interior for sponsoring SB 138. I particularly wanted to acknowledge our senators, Thomas and Passman, who have lent their support to the bill. You know, by supporting these marketing funds for ATIA, you are definitely supporting businesses throughout the state. I think it's been mentioned, but I just wanted to emphasize that entrepreneurialism is one of the hallmarks of the Alaska visitor industry. These local tourism business owners and their employees are your neighbors and your friends and your constituents. And as you all know I'm singing to the choir here, but tourism has a ripple effect throughout our communities. It generates construction, transportation, countless other services, infrastructure, and quality of life benefits to our communities. I just wanted to illustrate this point. Last week, March 9th through 12th, because of the hard work of the International and Trade Department of ATIA, Fairbanks hosted four tour operators, one from Australia, Germany, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and they spent 2.5 days with us, and they went to multiple places throughout the state in winter because of ATIA's efforts. And this probably means more to Senator Thomas and Passman, but I just want to quickly go through some of the small businesses that they stopped at and will hopefully bring tours in the winter, too. The Fountainhead Resorts properties, University of Alaska Museum of the North, which is really a statewide museum. It's part of the statewide system, and just wanted to note that 50% of the university museum's budget comes from visitors. They went to Brewster's Restaurant, Alpine Lodge, a new hotel locally owned. They went to the Yukon Quest headquarters, Pump House Restaurant, or Aurora Borealis Lodge. Farthest north, Harley-Davidson Outpost, Great Alaskan Bolt Company, Interior Fish Processors, Arctic Circle Tour, so they went north. They went to the World Ice Star Championships, dinner at Lavelle's, Ski Land, Taste of Alaska Lodge, Chena Hot Springs Resort. And I just quickly wanted to go through it just because it so illustrates the small businesses that are affected by the good marketing work of ATIA. The beauty of a state destination campaign is that it reaches a depth and breadth of potential customers that is far beyond the reach of most small businesses. And in this year, I've been in this business, I've been doing destination marketing since 1982, and I've been in Fairbanks for the past decade. But in this kind of atmosphere, destinations are fiercely competitive in general, but in these economic times, they're even more ferocious. And this bill, HB 138, just allows us sustainable funding so we can do what we do best, which is marketing Alaska, not necessarily knocking on the doors of the Hill, but marketing Alaska. And we thank you for your support.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Hickok? Seeing none, thank you. Mary Richards, are you available?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. This is Mary Richards. I live in Fairbanks and own All Seasons Inn, but I'm also president of the State Bed and Breakfast Association, and our nonprofit membership totals 211 members to our association. All 211 of those members are small business owners that depend on the help that we receive through ATIA for destination marketing. There's no way, as small business owners, that we could market independently to the European market or the Asian market or even to a lot of the national market in the U.S. So passing this bill would help each of us reach a market and be able to continue to sustain the livings that we make here. And most of us make our living solely in tourism. If tourism ended tomorrow, a lot of us would be in a world of hurt. It's going to be interesting this summer to see how we survive. And I think that we all understand where we are this summer, but that most of us are still looking to the future. And this bill not only hopefully will help us this year, but if we do have a really bad year this year, it will help us in looking forward to a better year next year as the economy improves. We feel that every dollar that is spent on marketing Alaska is money that comes back to us in Alaska many, many times over. It's not just us as individual owners, but it's also the people that we employ and our families. So we would urge you to come on board and help the 211 of us that work together to market bed and breakfast in Alaska through your efforts with ATIA and Destination Marketing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mary Richards? Seeing none, I believe that those are all the people that have indicated telephonically that they wanted to sign or discuss this with the committee. Are there any witnesses here that are in this room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 138? Seeing none, and apparently there's no one off-site, we will close public testimony on Senate Bill 138. Would the committee, what would we like to do? What discussion of Senate Bill 138? Senator Meyer, what are your thoughts?
I think we ought to move it.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'll make a motion.
Senator Bundy started earlier with maybe he may have a motion.
Well, actually, no. But looking at the number of sponsors and the number of people on the committee, I suspect that this bill has an opportunity. But as always, I'd like to point out unintended consequences and the no free lunch. I referenced a report earlier, and we hear numbers banding around about different amounts of money that come to the state. Businesses have to worry about their bottom line, absolutely, and I want them to succeed, no question. But I think our job, in part, is to worry about the state's bottom line. The bottom line for the state is tourism generates about $25 million for the general fund. If this works the way you intend it to work, the tourism will be generating about $15 million or less for the state. We just need to be aware of that. And the industry needs to be aware of that, because when they come back and tell us wonderful things they're doing for the state, their bottom line, or our bottom line, has decreased. And as has been said in many forums here, 2 or 3 years, the state's going to be hurting for money. And I hope we're not robbing Peter to pay Paul when this bill advances. I've heard the word sustainable several times. And this is sustainable as long as the cruise industry chooses to stay in Alaska. The minute that doesn't please their bottom line, they're gone. And this plan is no longer viable. So, with those cautions, I turn it back to you.
Any further discussion of this committee? Senator Thomas?
I move that, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that CS for Senate Bill 138 /P is the one we're talking about, correct? Is that right?
Correct.
Be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Or note.
Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 138 has passed the Senate. Labor and Commerce Committee. We'll take a brief at ease for signing. Order. We will now address Senate Bill 97, and this is a crane operators licensing bill. And anyway, it is proposed by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. I'd like to just read a few points on the record. In the past few years, crane accidents around the nation have caused numerous workplace deaths and millions of dollars in property damages, and there are handful of articles in the newspaper about these accidents in the back of your packet, the bill packet. Although Alaska has not experienced a major crane accident for several years, there is a chart also as part of your bill packet that documents 10 fatalities in our state as a result of crane accidents. These deaths and the alarm sounded by accidents across the rest of the nation should not be ignored by this state. Although some of these accidents were the result of circumstances beyond the operator's control, a majority resulted from operator error. Senate Bill 97 is a proactive step to avoid more crane-related catastrophes in Alaska by establishing minimum licensing standards to ensure that operators are adequately qualified. The state of Alaska currently requires licensing for numerous occupations, from barbers and hairdressers to veterinarians. Licensing requirements are designed to protect the public by ensuring that individuals are properly qualified to engage in a particular field of enterprise. Currently, 16 states and six municipalities have passed legislation to require crane operator licensing, and legislation is pending in six more states. The majority of these licensing requirements establish a requirement for certification through the National Commission for the Certification of Crane Operators. That's called NCCCO, or an equivalent nationally accredited training provider. This legislation will not create a burden on state revenues, as licensing fees will pay for enforcement costs subject to legislative appropriation. More importantly, it demonstrates a serious commitment to workplace safety by the state of Alaska. And I want to thank Dave Lacks, Chief Operating Officer of BC Contractors in Anchorage, who submitted a letter of support that states, quote, "As a general contractor, BCC is committed to job site safety and wants to be able to know its crane operators have the necessary skills and training to safely operate cranes." Senate Bill 97 will help ensure workplace and public safety through the following provisions: licensing with certifications through NCCCO or equivalent, supervision standards for crane operator trainees, standards for reporting crane-related accidents, significant penalties for violations, and sustainable funding for enforcement. I would now like to invite Gray Mitchell, Director of Labor Standards and Safety at the Department of Labor and Workplace Development, to offer additional testimony and answer any questions that this committee may have.
Yes, online. My name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. First off, I'd like to thank the sponsor and the committee for hearing this proposed legislation and shining a light on crane safety, and that's a personal message from Commissioner Quick Bishop. I apologize for not being there. I'm presently presenting at the Governor's Safety Conference, so this bill is extremely timely for the committee to consider, and I want to, some of the comments that I have, I think, are a reiteration of Senator Pascavant's comments, I'll try to be as brief as possible. But I wanted to bring your attention to some of the recent accidents that have happened across the nation to highlight the dangers associated with crane operations. In March 15th, 2008, there was an accident in New York that killed six construction workers and a tourist who just happened to be bystanding, and then injured 24 additional workers, some of which were emergency responders who came to rescue people who had been involved in the crane accident. Just 10 days after that, an accident in Miami killed 2 construction workers and injured 5 more. On May 30th of 2008, another accident in New York killed 2 workers, injured 1 worker, and injured another bystander. In Oklahoma, a crane accident during a church steeple setting ceremony killed an elderly bystander who was there just to take in the event. I've been told that the crane that was just down the street on Main Street has been moved, but for those of you who saw that crane right there next to the Silver Bow restaurant on Main Street, if you just take a minute to think about what might have happened if that crane had an accident and, you know, the load was miscalculated or some other conditions, windy conditions, caused an accident and that crane tipped over into Main Street or onto adjacent buildings, it would be a catastrophe. When you consider what's at stake, it's very clear how important it is to make sure that the person sitting in that seat is adequately trained and qualified. As Senator Pascavan mentioned, we have licensing laws for numerous occupations. The truck driver that drives a crane to the site, the explosive handlers that are working on the project across the street from where the crane was located, a realtor who sells you your house, even the person who cuts your hair, have to meet training requirements, pass an examination, and obtain a license. But for crane operators, those requirements just aren't there. You may have read recently about a worker in Anchorage who was killed a few days ago while he was operating a forklift in Anchorage. This worker, although there are training requirements for forklift operators, hadn't been properly trained and certified. And as a result, it's fairly clear that it cost him his life. Current OSHA regulations really are not adequate. The regulations in the construction standard require that crane operators are qualified based on a standard that's more than 40 years old. The standard is not detailed, and so it leaves an employer up to their best judgment, essentially, to determine what to train the employee in and what to make sure they're competent in. And there's no standard that says you have to have so many hours or you have to pass, you know, a certain battery of tests or those kinds of things. OSHA's in the process of amending their crane regulations, but there's hearings actually this week on the standard, and the estimate right now is that there won't be a final standard in effect until maybe 2016. Some might say we should just wait for the federal government to solve the problem. However, it's important to note that this legislation goes a step beyond OSHA regulations, and really when you take into account that many of the deaths and injuries that have been caused recently by crane accidents and the exposure involved, that there is a significant threat to the public as well. And OSHA regulations don't necessarily apply to public safety provisions. So this crane licensing requirement would cover the dangers to the public as well. By establishing a licensing provision that requires applicants to be certified by a nationally accredited crane training and certification provider, Alaska will be taking a positive step toward minimizing the chances for a catastrophic crane accident. It's important to take note of what's happened in other areas where crane licensing and certification has been required. The Canadians have been up to this for several years. And Ontario passed a requirement in 1978. They did a study and compared to the 10-year period prior to that crane certification requirement, they saw a 75% reduction in deaths related to crane accidents in more than double that period after the certification requirement. In California, they compared the 3 years prior to their certification requirement to the 3 years after their certification requirement, and they saw an 80% reduction in deaths and a 56% reduction in injuries related to crane accidents. So this really works. Although Alaska hasn't seen a major accident for several years, that really is not a good reason to not address this problem. For a 10-year period from 1987 to 1997, Alaska experienced 15 crane accidents under the state and federal OSHA jurisdictions in Alaska, and those accidents caused the death of 10 employees and serious injuries to 11 more employees. With the stimulus projects hitting the streets and potential natural gas pipeline on the horizon, Alaska can see can expect to see a lot more crane use coming. To gauge industry sentiment towards crane operator licensing, the Department of Labor last summer mailed a survey to 569 companies likely to operate cranes. We didn't even send a paid postage envelope, and we still got 128 of those responses back. So there was a tremendous amount of interest in providing input on this important issue. There were several responses that were opposed to the concept of licensing, but 82% indicated that certification would reduce accidents, and 70% of those respondents indicated that crane operators should be licensed to work in Alaska. It's important to note that there are several industry categories that this legislation does not apply to. The definition of construction, excavation, and demolition, as provided in the proposed legislation, does not apply to cranes used for general industrial purposes, that is, non-construction related purposes, in the industries of transportation, commercial fishing, logging, mining, oil and gas exploration, or manufacturing. The overwhelming number of accidents in the construction industry has essentially pressed the department to focus on that industry first. So that's the thrust of this legislation, and that's where we're focusing our efforts. We urge the committee to pass this important legislation, and we hope that, that can be done in the near future to avoid the chances that we might experience a catastrophic accident in Alaska. And I thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to the committee today.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Hi, Gray. All those accidents you quoted at the beginning of your testimony, were all the crane operators uncertified?
Well, through the chair, Senator Bundy, I don't have that information. I'd have to dig a little bit deeper. We can certainly check to see if those records are available. The crane certification process, and I'm sitting here with Jerry Andrews, who's a crane operator and may have some of the historical knowledge to be able to address this, but crane certification in the United States it hasn't been around for that long. And so I don't know if the accidents that I referred to from 1987 to 1997, which is, we're talking 10 to 20 years ago, if there really were even certified operators in Alaska at that time at all.
Obviously, if I might, Mr. Chairman, obviously those accidents didn't happen in Alaska, but...
I'm sorry.
You'd made the point you want to reduce accidents, and of course I think we all would, but I guess the point I was getting at is that even certified operators could make mistakes and have accidents. Isn't that true?
That is certainly true. I think what we're talking about, pardon me through the chair, is just the opportunity to ensure and to minimize the chances that someone would have an accident through ensuring that the person sitting at the controls has proven that they are qualified. Right now, we really don't have that.
Yeah, if I might, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering if you could walk me through the process. A young Alaskan decides they want to be a crane operator. How would they get the training? How do they get certified by this group that does the certifying? thrust of my question is I'm concerned about gatekeeping. You know, if you want to be a pipeline welder and your great-granddad wasn't a member of the Pipeline Welders Union, you got no chance. So is there a danger of some gatekeeping here that you keep the number of operators down and the price of operators up? Well, how do you become an operator?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I think what you're getting at is, you know, how difficult is it to get the training in Alaska? And right now, it is a little bit minimal. There is one operation that's approved to provide the training and to actually provide the examinations in Alaska, and that's the Alaska Crane Consultants out of Kenai. And the other place where a person can get trained is through the Equipment Operators Union. Let me go into the cost just a little bit. There is a charge for the written exam, which runs about $265, and then for the practical exam where the person is actually operating the crane, and this is through the Alaska Crane Consultants operation in Kenai, it's $410. So you're looking at $675 to, you know, get licensed up as a crane operator. Typically, these individuals would have worked as a trainee under the supervision of a licensed crane operator, you know, for several years and, you know, gained some experience in the seat, although that's not a requirement at this point. You know, the real question here is, you know, when you have this young worker who's showing skills and aptitudes towards operating a crane, you know, typically you have an employer who's invested in that worker. And once they, you know, I mean, it's what we're proposing, although, you know, the bill essentially gives the department authority to establish the fee by regulation, and requires that the fee cannot be more than it costs to administer the program. We've estimated a fee of $50 a year, and so we'd have a trainee who would essentially, for a $50 fee, which is one of the lowest occupational licensing fees that we've seen, could go to work for an employer, you know, learn the skills that they would need to sit for this exam. And more than likely, when you have an employer who's got this type of worker that they've already invested some experience time in, they're going to be fitting this, you know, this $675 bill. I know that's not necessarily a great explanation of, you know, covering the costs, but it's not a tremendous barrier.
Thank you.
Mr. Gray, if you could, or Mitchell, excuse me on that, if you could comment on the 17.5 tons issue as far as what is the thought that's going through your mind as far as that 17.5 tons.
Mr. Chairman, I have Jerry Andrews here with me, and he, you know, my knowledge of cranes, you know, is essentially limited to what I've done in terms of working on this bill, and he's got years and years and years of crane experience, and he's given me the nod that he can probably answer that kind of a question better.
Through the chair, this is Jerry Andrews. I am the apprenticeship coordinator for the state through the Department of Labor, and previously I was an instructor of crane training, a crane operator tester, and also I am a certified crane operator. In the four categories that is listed under the NCCO, which is the recognized standard that meets the bar for this, and we're aware of others that have met the bar that can also meet the requirement of being a certification agency. The 17.5 ton has been chosen by the industry as a size that does not allow for the operator to swing with the load. The 17.5-ton is recognized as the fixed cabs or the boom trucks. And then if it's greater than 17.5 tons for a hydraulic crane, the classification generally has a swinging cab. So that's where the 17.5-ton limitation comes from. NCCO has broken the certification into four categories: small hydraulics under 17.5 tons, large hydraulics over 17.5 ton, lattice boom truck, and lattice boom crawler.
Okay. Thank you much. Any questions of Mr. Anders of the committee?
Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Meyer?
Yeah, and I apologize. I didn't hear all the testimony, but are most of the cranes in Alaska under 17.5?
Through the chair, once again, this is Jerry Andrews. I believe that the lion's share of the cranes would be larger than 17.5 ton used in commercial application. For the most part, the boom trucks that we see setting trusses, they're generally over 17.5 tons, but there's a fair amount of those used in electrical trade or something of that nature that might be less than the 17.5 tons.
Okay, thank you.
Any further question of Mr. Anders or Mr. Mitchell? Seeing none, we have two people located, Mr. Alan Wilson. Please identify yourself and state your affiliation and provide your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alan Wilson. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska State Home Building Association today. We appreciate you taking the time to hear us on this matter. The association is opposed to this bill as it's written, and I'm going to explain to you how we use what we call the common knowledge term is for boom trucks rather than cranes. We think there's a pretty substantial difference in these pieces of equipment. Typically, boom trucks are used for setting trusses, as you've already heard. That happens typically as they're on the job site, you know, maybe an hour, maybe 4 or 5 hours, and they're gone. A lot of us as general contractors use boom trucks for setting large beams, that sort of thing. It's quite common for the general contractor to go to the rental yard, pick up the truck, you run back, you set your beams, and the whole ordeal is over and done with in just a few hours. Boom trucks are typically used a lot in panelized construction. Well, they set all the prefab wall sections in place, similar to what we saw just down the street here from the Capitol building this last week or so. The our concern with the licensing bill is that currently there's one instructor in the state, and that's of concern, since if we're going to require all boom trucks to be licensed or run by licensed operators, where do these operators come from? It's my understanding there's currently one operator in Juneau licensed current by the NCCO people, I believe it is. So what do we do with that situation? As I see it right now, if this bill should pass, when I need my trusses set, the truss company is going to have to wait and schedule with the boom or the crane operator guy, licensed operator, and you know he's working full-time on a big crane, what I would consider a crane, not a boom truck. So we see this as just not only being obstacles and just to getting our work done, our limited amount of building season time, but also the additional cost, because if you've got one guy in town or two, three guys in town, and they've got all the goodies in their bag, of course the cost is going to go up for that. The I think that's kind of in a nutshell our biggest opposition. We do have I have some photos here that I just ran off the internet here yesterday trying to come up with a boom truck, and what we're going to request of the committee is to consider limiting the bill's effectiveness to tonnage, and we want to throw the number of 20 tons out. And I have some photos, and I'll certainly pass these around. I have a photo of a 15-ton boom truck, an 18-ton boom truck, and a 20-ton boom truck. If anyone can tell the difference between these, I'd sure like to know that. And it seems to me that the department would want to draw the line at a number that is visually easy to distinguish, so you're not running down a 15-ton boom truck supposed violation when it's in fact it's something else. We think there's room in the on page 6 of the bill under the exemption section to raise that limit to the 20-ton section. Currently, it's capacity greater than 5 tons. We think you could simply add 20 tons there. That would certainly take care of our concerns. If that doesn't work, we have another option. We'd like to suggest that up again, page 6, and under the exemptions, line 4, we could simply add cranes used in the residential construction of 1- and 2-family homes. We feel that that would also take care of our concerns and our issues. If you want to get more complicated than that, I think you could add the definition of boom truck down under C, line 17, and then then you'd have to add another subsection 5 to define what a boom truck actually is. We'll leave that up to the department to figure out. One of the questions that arose when we were reading through this bill trying to figure out how it was going to affect us is who does it apply? Does it apply to the guy that's actually pulling the levers and pushing the buttons, or is it the guy that's on the ground directing him? Many times when we're setting trusses, for example, the guy that's running the crane or the boom truck can't see what he's doing. You've got some guy that's on the other side of the building that's making eye contact with the load and making eye contact with the operator, and he's twirling his hands in the air and looks pretty goofy out there, but these guys have some sort of communication system going. Who does this apply to? Does it apply to both of them, the guy pulling the levers or the guy giving the directions? Bill might want to clarify that. Short of that, the next thing I'd like to add is just that in reading through some of the Department of Labor's information they handed out, and I believe you all have it in your packet, going through these accidents nationwide, it appears, by my quick calculation, 26 nationwide, 24 of those were commercial projects. We just don't see the need to regulate boom trucks on residential construction sites. I don't think that the record demonstrates that there's a tremendous risk of injury in these situations. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any questions of the committee of Mr. Wilson? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we heard about all the accidents that had happened, and I believe most of those probably were pertaining to high-rise buildings instead of residential like you're talking about.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that's my understanding as well. We've amongst ourselves tried to figure out statewide if there's any residential construction sites that had a boom truck or crane accident, and amongst the 20 some of us at the meeting, nobody could recall any such accident.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, another question. I noticed in your pictures here that the crane truck, whatever, it says rent me. So I'm assuming I could go down and rent one of these, and it's not up to the rental store to know if I'm certified.
Again, to the chair, Senator Meyer, that's 100% correct. I did speak with the local rental yard, and they currently have a 17.5-ton boom truck that they rent that I occasionally rent. They're looking at a 19.5-ton, and the reason being is that the boom's a little bit longer and you get more reach. Of course, with more reach comes less weight you can move. They do not require any licensing. Anyone in this room could go rent that boom truck today. However, when you sign that lease document, you just bought yourself a crane, and you better return it in the same manner, or it could be a very expensive ordeal.
So if I understand what you're saying, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
A 20-ton truck, would you don't need that long of a, what do you call it, the arm?
Boom.
Boom, yeah, thank you. Okay, thanks.
What I was wondering, not of this witness, but of Mr. Anders, is he still online?
This is Jerry.
Yes, this is Senator Pascven, and what I was wondering is, with respect to the issue of the boom truck and the difference in the 20 versus 15 or 17 ton issue, would you care to comment upon that?
At this time, I agree with previous testimony that the controls and the design are quite similar between a 15 or 17 and a half and a 20 ton boom truck. The division comes when we get into the certification agency and the industry. The industry has recognized it at 17 and a half ton, and the certification folks, which is the Specialized Carriers and Riggers Association. They've identified it at 17 and a half ton. Other than that, I do not have any comment on that.
Senator Bundy?
Well, my question would be, and I thought there was not only the weight, but another category, and that is, we've all seen the big cranes where you, the operator's in a cab versus the boom truck where the guy's sitting on the back of the bed of the truck. It's 17 and a half in a cab, or was the fact that the crane was operator was in a cab, movable cab? Are both those categories, or one or the other, used to differentiate when you need a license?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, the 17 and a half ton number, it could be a fixed cab, or it could be a boom truck, or it could be a swinging cab. Once again, on the 20 ton, it could be a boom truck, it could be a fixed cab, or it could be a swinging cab. When you get in that little overlap area, there becomes a little confusion. And I can appreciate the argument for the 17 and a half versus the 20 ton.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, perhaps when the committee goes through their markup process, and they want to consider that differentiation of a swinging cab versus the boom truck, or how or you define a boom truck as not having a swinging cab.
Mr. Anders is from a matter of public safety. If you would directly comment upon the difference on a boom truck up to 20 ton. Is that something that, as a matter of public safety, what are your thoughts on that?
As a matter of public safety, any of these projects that have a lifting device, a crane or a boom truck, the highest category and the greatest risk is not for the operator. It is for the folks that are working around that operator and the folks working on the ground and the bystanders. And that be the case, I don't think that the division between 17 and a half ton or 20 ton would make that or break that argument. It's electrocution, it is ground stability and those issues. And as you increase the size of the and capacity of the crane, you increase the risk. I hope that answers the question.
Well, possibly if I would address it a little differently, one of these suggestions by the witness was including within the definition of crane on page 6 that it does not include and it like a knuckle boom or stacker or lift truck, power shovel. I believe he indicated a 20-ton boom truck, a 20-ton or less boom truck. Is that something that would be an acceptable non-exclusion in the application of this Senate bill?
Through the chair, I would like to defer that back to the Occupational and Safety Group, Gray Mitchell's office, and we could explore that a little further to make sure that the intent of the legislation would be based on safety, and that would be my only concern. So at this time, I would like to have the opportunity to report back later on that.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Anders. Yes, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, just one thing. If I understood Director Mitchell's testimony correctly, it sounds like the OSHA is going to have a requirement soon on these types of pieces of equipment. Currently, we have our certificates to show that by OSHA, required by OSHA, that demonstrates that we've had some training on forklifts and what we define as zoom booms, these extendable forklift trucks. I'm assuming that OSHA is going to have a similar process in place soon, is what it sounded like to me. So it sounds like there will be some requirements by OSHA to already cover at least to the 20-ton limit anyways. May go beyond that, I'm not sure, but that's my final comment.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Ralph, and I can't pronounce the last name, is there from Chatham Electric? Please identify yourself and state your affiliation.
Senators, Chair, Thank you. For the record, my name is Ralph Kibbe. I'm the owner of Chatham Electric, a statewide electrical contractor, and a member of the National Electrical Contractors Association. Last month, we met with the chair of this legislation and identified some of the problems our industry has with legislation as it is currently written. And Chair, I owe you an apology. It's been a month. I had said that I would get back to you with written recommendation or documentation anyway, and I was unable to do so. As you know, in private business, it's awfully hard to try to keep up with a lot of the legislation that's taking place, especially this time of year. Also, as a member of NECA, we did poll our folks, and they haven't had enough time in which to respond. The response that I did have at this point in time was, it needs much more work. First, I'd like to know, like you folks know, as a business owner, I believe all accidents are preventable. And that's how I believe that the folks that authored this are looking at it. I'm committed to providing you folks with data that would help with any amendments to ensure the resulting law does not severely impact the companies across Alaska. We are not able to provide that data, but I offered that myself, NECA, we're willing to work with the committee, Department of Labor, and maybe the next committee as to how we can get there. Chatham Electric has several boom trucks, truck cranes, however you want to look at them. I could add with this that the 20-ton isn't even enough. I can give you a picture of a 30-ton. That wouldn't look any different than the pictures that were passed around to you. I could also answer the question, Senator Meyer, that you, unless you had a CDL license and were capable of running something 26,000 pounds and over, you wouldn't be able to go rent that crane, or you shouldn't be able to. You have to be licensed to for that tonnage of that crane, not the tonnage of what it can pick, but its gross vehicle weight. We have up to 30 employees that currently operate our cranes. I can assure you, as an owner, I do not allow anyone to operate a Chatham Electric crane that has not been trained to do so. I noticed under the exemptions, we were talking about electricians' line work, but Chatham Electric performs three disciplines: line, telecommunications, and wireman. We work with transmission distribution. We work intersections, lighting. We work residential. We work industrial. We work commercial. We work all over the state. Every one of the folks at Chatham Electric has to be capable of operating that crane. Where the tonnage may be at, I really don't know. But I know that the way this legislation is written for myself, that it is a financial impact, a huge financial impact and a burden. In fact, when we were, Mr. Gray was talking about the apprentices, that would require them on the job training, as written, would require that a supervisor would have nothing but the duty of attending to the operator, the apprentice operator that was operating that crane. Again, over 30 people at our company are capable of operating the crane. The other situation is that everyone, the folks that work at Chatham Electric, has certificate of fitnesses, electrician, lineman. Our industry is heavily regulated, not just with OSHA, MSHA, and others. Just a typical crane every year, we have to go through certification that crane is in operating conditions for which it was intended. The hot sticks on that crane have to be certified. The gloves the men use have to be certified. I would not want an operator that has a crane certification necessarily operating a crane under conditions in which we work within the electrical industry that has no certificate of fitness. And I don't want to be put in that situation either. Please forgive me. It's hard to testify trying to remember all this stuff. So
Most of us put on our pants one leg at a time.
Well, you know something, that helps. So under the exemptions, at some point in time, I would like to ask that we take further look at this, because it's not just linemen. There's electricians, telecommunications industry, and it goes much further than what I can speak to my industry. We do not work out of the operating engineers.
Thank you, Mr. Kibbe. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. I hear you use the word crane and boom truck kind of interchangeably, but in your business, is all of your equipment what I would call a boom truck without the movable cab on a crane?
I have to say, in my opinion, that it's a missing target. Some days it's a boom truck, some days it's a truck crane. I have no known definition, as the gentleman spoke early to, as what it is. I currently have a 24-ton boom truck crane that doesn't swing. So, I don't know how far we take this. We have 60,000-pound excavators that we use to pick loads and lift them and move equipment and whatnot around. I understand where we're headed. I just need more time to really digest this. We've had 1 month in which to really look at this to understand the impact. Right now, it's a financial impact to Chatham Electric.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kibbe. I think we have one last witness. I believe it's online from the Anchorage LIO. Jared Hamlin from Anchorage or Wasilla. Excuse me, Mr. Kibbe.
I did have one last thing, please.
Okay.
Okay.
Please make it brief.
I do not wish to leave it at the 20-ton or wherever it heads, because we operate in excess of 50 tons. Thank you.
Jared, are you available?
Yes, this is Jared. I'm here.
Yes, I state your name, affiliation, and provide your testimony.
My name is Jared Hamlin. I'm with the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 302. I'd like to thank the sponsor of the bill and thank the committee for letting me talk right now. I'll make it short and sweet. I am in favor of this bill, and I would like it passed through this committee onto the next one. I have talked with a lot of our contractors that we represent, and the general consensus from them is that they would like to see some type of crane operation licensing put in place for multiple reasons. And I can't speak for them because they're not all here, but what I have heard back is on the business aspect of it, when they've looked at comparable data from other areas where this has been enacted, they have noticed lower comp rates, lower insurance rates, and things like that. Once again, I would like this bill to be passed through this committee. On to the next one.
All right. Mr. Hamlin, if you could comment upon the distinction that we've heard today, if you've been listening, between a 17.5 tons and a boom truck, and if you could comment upon that distinction, and up to, I believe, 20 ton, or that. Anyway, explain what your thoughts are on that.
I would like to a little bit. The place where that number actually comes from is under the NCCCO, the National Commission for the Certification of Crane Operation. They had to pick a standard that could be used across the United States in which they could properly certify crane operators in multiple areas, multiple districts, and things like that. So the industry standard, I'm holding one of the cards here in front of me because I'm actually a certified crane operator through them. That's the industry standard that they had picked, is the 17.5 tons, less than or more than. And that's where I believe it came from in this legislation here.
And you believe that that is, for a safety standard, is the most appropriate demarcation point?
Well, this was the people who make up the NCCO are the manufacturers of the cranes, the users of the cranes, the people who insure the cranes, and everybody who has anything to do with it. And they all sat down and hashed this out and looked at it in every which direction that they could. and this is what they came up with as the way that they felt best for the industry to be properly regulated across the United States. And for the reasons that they came up with this, I do not know that. I just know that this is the standard.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Hamlin. I don't believe that we have any further testimony. Is anyone here present? We will close public testimony on Senate Bill 97. And I think what we're going to do at the moment is hold that. Mr. Anders, I believe, said he wanted to get back to us on something, so I believe we will allow Mr. Anders and the director to get back with us. We do have a few moments here turning to Senate Bill 149, if everyone would turn to that. And I would, rather than myself making the opening remarks, if I could let Lori Horovec, Hovanek, excuse me, present her remarks. Sorry about that, Lori.
That's all right. That's a tough one. My name is Lori Hovanek, and I'm the director for the Division of Banking and Securities. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in favor of this bill. And also, if you have any questions that come up, I also have in the room and in the LIO office in Anchorage some folks who can answer some specific questions that I might not be able to. And also the section chief for the section within the division that regulates mortgage lending is available to answer some questions. So. As you know, the purpose of this bill is to bring our current mortgage lending statute into compliance with new federal requirements. And it seems like the ink was barely dry last year on our mortgage lending law that the legislature worked so hard to pass when Congress determined that it was important that there be a national component to the licensing of mortgage loan originators. And so last year they passed what's known as the Secure and Fair Enforcement for Mortgage Licensing Act of 2008, which I will refer to as the SAFE Act. And it places requirements on all states that they implement mortgage law that conforms to its requirements. And there's a deadline that states comply with that federal law of July 30th of 2009. So as soon as the division became aware of this, of the requirement for these federal changes that would need to be made to our statutes, we started working to determine what we needed to do to our statutes to bring it into conformance. And also, the SAFE Act also requires, besides certain requirements, that each state join a national mortgage licensing system for licensing mortgage loan originators. And so we have been attending weekly calls and are making the appropriate steps that we need to make in order to follow that requirement that we join this national licensing mortgage licensing system. We are on schedule to join the and be able to license our mortgage lenders in August 1st of this year. And in order to do so, we don't need to have our we need statutory authority in order to do so, and we also need the ability to pay the fee to join the National Mortgage Licensing System. And we anticipate that that fee will be the minimum fee given the number of mortgage loan licensees here in Alaska. But our our law does not need to be effective as of that date, but we need something enacted in order to give us authority to pay the money and to start licensing through this national licensing system. Some of the requirements under the SAFE Act.
Lori, and we're kind of at the end of the time, and okay. I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of briefly get the committee up to speed on this. And
good.
We would certainly welcome you back soon, because I know we're going to need to have a full workup on this, and kind of hit the high points of what you're trying to accomplish, and then we will invite you back very soon if that's
okay, great.
Thank you.
Did you want me to continue wrap up?
Whatever you would like to do to hit the high points on what you need and why you need it soon as compared to later.
Okay. I guess without going into a lot of detail of what we need to do, my main concern is that we meet the deadline of July 30th of this year. And whether we do that via this short bill that allows us to comply with a lot of the requirements via regulation, or if we're able to contribute to a longer version in statutory form, we're willing to work with the legislatures in any way to comply. So my main concern is that we not have HUD take over mortgage licensing in Alaska, and that's the result of non-compliance. If states don't comply, if we haven't joined the national licensing system by the deadline, if we don't have statutes enacted by July 30th of this year, then HUD, under the Federal SAFE Act, is required to step in and take over mortgage licensing within the state. So we hope to avoid that. We don't want to test the system. There are opportunity to apply for exemptions. However, HUD has not set any standards yet, and to my knowledge, no states have applied for an exemption. So,
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we've got to do it. The only question is, we do it via this bill or a different, longer bill. For what it's worth, my suggestion is, let's pass this bill. If they screw up doing regulations, we'll come back and put the strong arm of the legislature on them.
I promise
you're ready for a motion.
Well, I don't know if it's appropriate without opening up the public testimony, and it's 3:00. I think that we should probably, as I understand, Ms. Hovanec is in the works right now of trying to put together that blending of the small or large bill together so that everything works between the House and the Senate. Is that an accurate representation?
I take my direction from you, so
great. Okay. I think what we will do is we'll just hold this for now and welcome you back very soon, and so that we can accomplish what your goal is and do that in the most efficient manner. And I would, anyway, on that Senate Bill 149, I think we should just leave it at that for the moment. But I would like to make an announcement that the Labor and Commerce is having a joint committee meeting with the House Labor and Commerce, 8 a.m., Tuesday, March 24th, in the House Judiciary Room on the first floor, and we'll be hearing an overview from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and we will also be meeting on that same day, Tuesday, March 24th, at our regular time. And so that's the only additional time schedule. So with that, Labor and Commerce today, March 19th, is adjourned.